This is Nachyomi, Sefer Melachim Aleph, Chapter 7. Shlomo spent 13 years building a residential complex for himself, which included multiple buildings. He commissioned the construction of something called the House of the Forest of Lebanon, which was an airy kind of summer house with a lot of cross ventilation, a lot of windows, and seems to have received its name from the wooden planks that comprised its structure, or from its location. It might have been located outside of the city of Jerusalem in a wooded area. The house was elevated above the ground, resting on cedar pillars, and its roof was made of cedar planks. Windows lined the walls of this house, and an antechamber was in front of it. Shlomo also built a judgment hall that contained the throne, where he would sit to hear and rule on legal cases and disputes that were brought to him. Although the foundation and structure of the building was made from the finest smooth stonework, the roof, walls, and ceiling of this hall were covered in cedar paneling. King Shlomo's personal residence and the home he constructed for his wife, the daughter of Paro, were also built from smooth stone, but overlaid entirely with cedar paneling. All three of these buildings, the palace, the House of the Forest of Lebanon, and the Judgment Hall, were located in a single courtyard that was surrounded by three rows of stone and one row of wood, like the courtyard of the temple. It seems that although the materials used in its construction and its design mirrored that of these structures, the residence of the daughter of Paro was located elsewhere. So it wasn't actually part of this complex, even though it's mentioned here, because the materials that were used and the design was similar. Shlomo sent for another person named Hiram of Tzur, an artisan who was a member of the tribe of Naphtali. This is not the same Hiram that we read about before, who was a king. This person is a craftsman. And he comes to help with the stone and metal work necessary for the temple. Shlomo commissioned him to fashion a number of unique structures that would be placed at the entrance of the temple and that were totally original. They didn't correspond to anything that existed in the original Mishkan. For instance, two exquisitely decorated copper pillars were situated on either side of the entry to the complex, named Yachin and Boaz. They had names. The exact design, very ornate design that they had, is spelled out in the Pesukim. It's spelled out in the verses here, and you can find visual aids that will help you see some kind of representation, some kind of a rendition of what they probably looked like. Very, very ornate, large pillars. The Sea of Shlomo, Yam Shel Shlomo, was a large copper basin that contained a substantial amount of water, tens of thousands of gallons, and from which water would be drawn to purify the Kohanim for their service. It rested on the backs of 12 molten oxen, the front of whose bodies protruded from underneath the basin, but whose hindquarters faced away from the observer. In other words, if you walked around this large basin, you would see in every direction three oxen facing you. Hiram fashioned 10 copper lavers or washing stands with bases and large decorative chariot wheels. These were installed by the entrance to the temple, 5 on each side, and allowed the Kohanim to wash their hands and feet before going inside. So what that meant was that when you would walk up to the entrance of the temple, you would see these 5 washing stations on either side of you. You would see on one side the Yam Shel Shlomo. You would see to the right this large basin called the Sea of Shlomo. And you would also see Yachin uVoaz. You would see these two pillars or scepters, almost. They looked like they had bulbous tops in front of you as you approached the front of the Beit HaMikdash. The furnishings inside the Holy Temple were also more elaborate than those of the Tabernacle. Instead of just one menorah and one golden table, there were 10 of each. There were 10 menorot and 10 shulchanot. This increase, as well as the increase in the number of washing stations from 1 to 10, could be thought of as just a reflection of the growth of the population since the era of Moshe. There are more Kohanim, they need more washing stations. We want to represent the bread that's provided to us by Hashem with more shulchanot, more tables, because it's a much larger population, and so on. Could also just be that we want to emphasize the superiority of this new sanctuary to the previous one. So we do it by multiplying it by 10, which is a common number for emphasis. All of the implements designed to be used in the actual temple service were fashioned either from pure gold or pure brass, the quantity of which was so great that Shlomo didn't even bother to weigh them. He transferred the treasures that David's father had consecrated to the temple and placed them into its newly built storage rooms, or treasury. This chapter leads us to ask a couple of important questions. The first is an organizational difficulty. Why does the text begin by talking about the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, then shift to discussing Shlomo's own palatial complex, and then return again to complete its account of the Beit HaMikdash? Why didn't it just include all of the details related to the temple, such as Yachin uVoaz, these various copper implements, and the washing stations, and so on? Why wasn't this mentioned when the Beit HaMikdash was originally described? Why is it interrupted with Shlomo's personal building projects? A second question of interest is why Shlomo spent so much more time on his own palace, judgment hall, and antechambers than he did on the Holy Temple. Our rabbis generally take the view that this is a praise of Shlomo. He prioritized and rushed the building of the Mikdash in 7 years, but was much more leisurely about his own residence. Some modern interpreters have suggested the opposite, that really the undue emphasis that Shlomo placed on his own buildings, his summer home, his palace, is indicative of a level of immodesty on his part, and some kind of personality defect that might play a key role in his downfall later on down the road. In support of their critical view, these thinkers point out that Shlomo used the same materials and architectural style in his own edifices that he employed in the house of God, expensive hewn stone, cedar paneling, and so on, almost unconsciously conveying the idea that he saw his own majesty as on par with Hashem's. Now, we'll come back to that in a moment, but the commentaries, for good reason, spend much time deciphering the simple meaning of the verses in this chapter, just like in the previous chapter. So very little explanation of their deeper significance is really provided. Even translating the unusual terminology used in these sections is difficult, and that's what the commentaries invest much of their time on. So we have very little help from traditional sources when it comes to distilling some kind of message from these elaborate and detailed descriptions of architecture. We're not going to be able to get into all of them, of course, in the summary, but we want to look at a couple of the highlights, and we'll try to do our best on our own to develop what seems to be a persuasive and maybe original answer to some of these questions. There are certainly midrashim that suggest that even from the beginning of his construction of the Beit HaMikdash, Shlomo was already influenced by ulterior motives. And maybe we'll explore some of those ideas in later summaries. But right now, I would argue, on a simple literary level, that this chapter is better understood as idealistic in its portrayal of the king, not negative. I think that the text integrates its presentation of the construction of the temple and the construction of Shlomo's residential complex, not in order to criticize Shlomo, but in order to demonstrate that Shlomo saw his reign as a reflection and extension of Hashem's reign on earth, not as a substitute for it. Shlomo's complex is divided into three parts: the Hall of Judgment, the Summer Home, and the Royal Palace, all of which are surrounded by a walled courtyard. It is a mirror image of the temple, which is partitioned into the Devir, or Holy of Holies, the Hechal, and the courtyard, and which is surrounded also by a wall identical in composition to that of Shlomo's. It seems to me that the parallels extend even further than this. The Devir, the Holy of Holies, is in essence the Judgment Hall, or the symbolic throne of Hashem, who is always portrayed as Yoshev, sitting above the Kiruvim, Yosheva Kiruvim. And we know that the Kiruvim are on top of the Ark, or the large ones that Shlomo made actually sit on the floor of the Holy of Holies as well. In Divrei HaYamim, the Holy of Holies is called Hashem's footstool, which again evokes the imagery of the divine throne room. The Hechal, or Holy, is made of cedar wood, lined with windows, and has an antechamber in front of it, just like the House of the Forest of Lebanon, or the summer home of Shlomo, had windows all around, an antechamber in front of it. The royal residence is covered with cedar paneling and surrounded by its own courtyard, possibly imitating the third outer section of the Holy Temple that's called the courtyard, and had the sacrificial altar inside it. Despite all of these parallels, which we might be tempted to interpret in the negative way as competition between Shlomo's building and the Beit HaMikdash, one striking difference emerges, which is gold is all over the place in the Holy Temple. Everything is covered with gold. Almost every surface is covered with gold, but it's noticeably absent from Shlomo's own complex. We don't find gold in the Hall of Judgment. We don't find gold in his palace. We don't find gold in the house of the Forest of Lebanon. All of this suggests to me that Shlomo saw his own majesty and position as nothing but an instrument to establish justice on earth, as a representative of the true judge, Hashem. Because his sense of the importance of his role was inseparable from his understanding of the greatness of the Almighty and the primacy of his service, Shlomo's royal complex replicated the layout and motifs of the temple in many respects, and the descriptions of the two building projects are intertwined. The concept of Shlomo is not foreign to our tradition. In fact, we reference it in our prayers on a daily basis. In one of the blessings of the Amidah, we ask Hashem to provide us with great judges and advisors like we had in the old days. We follow up by stating that to be guided by such leaders is like being guided by Hashem. Righteous kings and judges don't push their own agendas. They're proponents of Hashem's plan, and they do their best to implement his plan through their decisions and actions. In that way, Torah leaders are the agents or messengers of Hashem. Shlomo is granted unprecedented power and authority and is prepared to judge his subjects wisely and fairly, not because he wants to revel in his newfound influence, but because he recognizes this is a sacred responsibility as the anointed one of Hashem. By applying the wisdom of Hashem to worldly affairs, he is bringing those matters not under his own jurisdiction, but under the governance of God. The Beit HaMikdash represents Hashem's providence in the world in a symbolic manner. It's a source of clarity, edification, inspiration. Shlomo's activities as king translate that awareness of Hashem into the language of practical politics. We know from our Torah and prophets that it's only when the Jewish people embody the values of charity and justice that they merit to have the Beit HaMikdash in their midst. Traditionally, the Beit HaMikdash was the center of religious worship, justice, and education. Shlomo HaMelech accentuates the connection between these three core values by modeling his own home and his courthouse after the house of God. But by dispensing with gold, of course, he shows that he is not on par with the Beit HaMikdash and what it represents. With this in mind, we can understand why the description of Shlomo's palace and judgment hall is followed by more details related to the vessels and furnishings of the Beit HaMikdash. The text first presents the Holy Temple as a place in which the divine presence will be manifest to and encountered by the Jewish people. This engagement with the Almighty inspires the nation to pursue the imitation of his ways in their conduct of national and personal affairs, represented and enforced by the king and his bureaucracy. However, to stop there would be to imply that the final destination of the experience of the divine was the courtroom of Shlomo. That would make Shlomo like other kings who used supernatural authority of religion to reinforce their own egos or their own grip on their subjects. Therefore, the text immediately shifts back to a discussion of the vessels of the temple, the implements used not in the passive appearance before Hashem, but in the active worship of Hashem. Ultimately, our establishment of a just and equitable society, presided over by a righteous monarch, is only a means to an end. It paves the way back to the Holy Temple, where we can learn Torah, reflect upon the true king's infinite wisdom, and devote ourselves to his service. This may be compared to the Torah's account of the revelation at Sinai, which is followed by the laws of civil society in Mishpatim, and only then by a description of the sanctuary to be constructed in the wilderness. I'd like to just add one more somewhat speculative observation for further consideration. Really, all of the parallels I mentioned here were my own thoughts. Hopefully, I think that they're getting to something that's a genuine connection, but here's something for further thought. The house of the forest of Lebanon may be a reference to the phraseology we find in Psalm number 96. Yiram hayamum lo'o, we say that the sea should roar, and we say, that all the trees of the forest should sing for joy before Hashem. Kiva kiva lishpot haaretz, because he's coming to judge the earth. Ishpot tevel betzedek v'amim b'mesharim, or v'amim b'emunato, he's going to judge the world in righteousness and the people in faithfulness. Similarly, in Psalm number 29, the very famous one, we say, Kol Hashem shover, well, we say, shover arazim, by shaber Hashem et arzei Lebanon, that the voice of Hashem breaks cedars and breaks the cedars of Lebanon. This is a metaphoric reference to the power brokers and tyrants who seem invincible and unstoppable, but are in reality unable to stand up against or thwart the will of God. Metaphorically, the mighty trees of the forest tremble before Hashem's majesty and judgment. These mighty trees in Tehillim are really a reference to people who are mighty. But Shlomo HaMelech, in spite of all these of his achievements, still saw himself as a humble and reverent servant in the presence of the Almighty. Calling his home Forest of Lebanon may have been an attempt to express that by using the imagery of Tehillim, the idea that even the greatest person still must tremble before Hashem, and that Shlomo applied that principle to himself.